So anyway, we were enjoying the Nietzsche stuff the last couple of casts. That was good. I mean, the mess in WTF Mansions, unbelievable carnage. I mean, that's the thing, I think, with, you know, inviting Vanessa to come and help out. Very good at the kind of presenting the information. But a bit slovenly. I mean, she leaves a lot of mess around. You know, there's like Nietzsche texts everywhere. There's empty bottles of you know, 6X lying around. There's like daiquiri glasses. So, you know, I've been doing a lot of cleaning up. I know you've been busy kind of sweeping up downstairs, which is good. It's looking very nice downstairs. I'd keep away from the West Wing because the toilets there are backed up.
What is that smell?
I have no idea. I mean, I was looking. It was like looking into the abyss. And I swear to God, it looked back at me, whatever's going on there. So keep out of the West Wing anyway, Danny. But I think we'll get ourselves sorted out eventually. Right. But yeah, but it was interesting, isn't it? Because I think we're getting to that point now, I think, in the discussions where it's difficult to kind of nail down the prime philosophical mover of the moment and chart a kind of progression. So kind of you can't just say, okay, and now Plato. And now Aristotle, it's getting to that point now where things are starting to diverge. There are movements which are evolving into other things, and I think part of it is to do with kind of mass travel, mass communication beginning to kind of be a big thing. These ideas disseminate much more quickly, and variants of them develop. I was looking at a bit of phenomenology. Kind of, you know, I have to admit, and I know, you know, people have tried to pin me down on, you know, you've got your Wittgenstein, and that's your guy, and people have sort of said, oh, you know, Mike got a guy, what's his guy, you know, I have to say that the phenomenologists are my guys. I'll come right out and say that. I think Vanessa was asking about this, and I just fobbed her off with something. You know, your Husserls and your Heideggers and your Sartres and your Merleau-Ponty's and your Levinas's, these are my guys. So it's kind of not like having one person who I hated, but the phenomenology movement. There are good reasons I think why I like this stuff. But it's not easy to get your head round. Because they don't write in a particularly easy way, but also there are lots of variations. So you're never entirely sure. There are family resemblances, but so I thought we might have a bit of a chat about that. Maybe a little bit of a chat about. We're not going to get them all in because these are big thinkers. And we might spread them out, but I mean, quite a lot to have a little chat about maybe Husserl, maybe. And some of the phenomenology. Husserl is basically the kind of the guy who's associated with the beginnings of phenomenology. So maybe have a little chat about that. I don't know if I've sprung that on you, Danny. Whether whether your big book of philosophy is whether you got whether you got.
I have a kind of a little bit of a working knowledge, but I probably, you know, I wouldn't say I'm an expert or anything like that. But wouldn't you say that here is this kind of fork in the road between analytic and continental, is that right?
Yeah, I think you probably could say that, yes. We're just coming out of the big Enlightenment kind of thinkers, people like kind of Kant and Hegel, who are trying to establish what it is to understand, to know things, and the nature of knowledge, and our engagement with it, and so on. And they both both Kant and Hegel used the term phenomena and phenomenology. So they introduced the terminology. But when Husserl, in the mid 19th century, beginnings of the 20th century, when he starts talking about phenomenology, he means something different to what, say, for example, Kant might mean when he talks about phenomena, and what Hegel means when he talks about phenomenology. But there are vestiges. You can see a family resemblance. You can see a trajectory here. So One of the things I like, I mean, I think one of the things I like particularly about Husserl, for example, is his understanding of consciousness. I think that's quite attractive because we've had that kind of Enlightenment, kind of Cartesian idea where consciousness is a sort of a, it's a sort of a box in our heads, and that box in our head is filled up with experiences and data and things. So consciousness is separate from the world in a way. So it's our, that's kind of our mind, and Kant kind of builds on that with a kind of transcendental method where he says, well, the consciousness in a sense is what gives order to the world. So there's the real objects in the world, the natural world, which the thing in itself, which we can't have anything to do with, and then we've got the human consciousness, which structures that into representations that we can actually understand. So we never really deal with the real thing. We're only dealing with representations in our mind.
We can't deal with the real thing, right?
No. That's right. The thing in itself is beyond us. Now, one of the kind of the rallying cries of Husserl and the phenomenologists was back to things in themselves. Back to the things in themselves. And it was kind of Husserl more or less saying, okay, well, we need to start having more confidence that we are inhabiting our world, that it's not a mysterious thing that we can't have any access to. It's the world we access is not some kind of second order reproduction of the real world. We can get back to the things in themselves. And Husserl was very much in favour of, he was quite scathing about previous philosophies in a way. He was saying that what we've ended up with is philosophical systems which describe the world for us before we engage with them as individuals. Yeah. So it's kind of so all of intellectual history is kind of already telling us what the world is, almost as a separate thing to how you and I actually individually engage with it. And he says this is not really where we need to be. Consciousness isn't something we own in a kind of passive sense. Some tea has just appeared. Just by the side. That's great, isn't it? I mean, it's better than this. We're drinking tea now.
Some whiskey in it.
I could put some whiskey in it, yeah. So it reminds me of that kind of Blackadder thing, is where Blackadder's trying to pretend that he's a kind of hardcore drinker. And he says to Baldrick, when I ask for my really strong beer, bring me some water, because he's obviously a lightweight. This is my really strong tea. Where were we? And do feel free to interrupt. I mean, consciousness is not like a passive thing. It's not an empty thing. That kind of subject-object distinction. It's not the kind of the empty consciousness waiting to be filled with things. Husserl says that consciousness, in a way, is something that takes place in our engagement with the world. So consciousness is almost something that's outside us. Consciousness. So I'm looking at this cup of tea, for example, and my consciousness is out here. It's incorporating the tea. It's making the tea my own. It's making the tea part of my world. In a way that it's not part of your world, because you're at a distance from it in a way, or it's not being, maybe you don't like tea.
Is this that word, intentionality?
It's intentionality, yeah. All consciousness, he says, is active. It's always directed towards something. It's never empty. It's never kind of waiting for something to fill it. It's always directed towards or connected to something. It's interesting, actually, because I mean, Sartre, who has quite a lot of respect for Husserl, is part of the kind of phenomenological movement. I mean, he said at one point, I really like this, that the mind is not a stomach. So it's not like an empty stomach which just like eats experiences and data, and is waiting to be filled up and to consume stuff. And he gets this from Brentano, who is another philosopher that Searle was very impressed with. Sartre was like him, was kind of one of the grand sort of, you know, men of philosophy and sociology back in the 19th century. And Brentano makes a similar kind of thing. Consciousness isn't a box; it's not passive. That our consciousness is our involvement in the world. And I quite like that. I mean, consciousness is everything. I mean, and you can get smatterings in a sense. You can kind of parlay that into a kind of almost a kind of Hegelian, not pantheism, but that kind of Hegelian idea that we're all part of a kind of a single entity. Now he has it in a kind of almost a semi sort of religious kind of way. Does Hegel, but the idea that consciousness is everything—it's my being engaged with the world. It's spread out across the world. It's not kind of, you know, me and you as two separate entities. It's not me and this cup of tea as separate entities. This cup of tea is part of me. It's part of my world, and we inhabit. You know, we are one of the things that we find with a number of postmoderns, people like, you know, Maurice Merleau-Ponty, for example, and the like. The idea of kind of inhabitation. Being in a world, you have Heidegger. We might mention later on, talks about situatedness. You know, we're situated in a world, and and it's not as if it's us in the world. So it's always active. Consciousness is always active. It's always conscious of something. It's never. If it's empty, it's not conscious of anything.
Yeah.
So consciousness is exterior. It's not interior. And I like that. I mean, is that something that appeals to you?
Yeah. I mean, I'm struggling really. My mind is working like crazy, trying to understand it or trying to grasp parts of it. I understand it in some ways. So I'm always, or I feel like I'm a step backwards, you know. So one of the things of trying to understand the world is the convention. So if we both understand what, you know, an apple is, is that because both our consciousnesses are working at at the same level of the apple? We're grasping something that's kind of work. It's not the essential apple, but the kind of phenomenological apple.
Yeah.
I've lost it.
Yeah. Yeah. No. It's an interesting one because I mean one of the problems with this, and other philosophers have tried to respond to this, but it's difficult to get away from it, is that there is an element of subjectivity involved in this. Now, Husserl wants to say, you know, Husserl doesn't want to suggest that there is not a natural world. He says, kind of, there is a natural world. There is, you know, there is a world out there, for example, and, you know, there is an apple. You know, if you see an apple, there's an apple. But the natural encounter, the natural existence of the apple. Too philosophical for some of our listeners who are not particularly well trained in the language. But Husserl is not interested in ontology particularly, so he's not bothered. He thinks it's actually quite trivial to talk about the existence of a thing. It's the meaning of the thing that's important. So the existence of a thing is kind of just its natural state, and that's not significant. It's not necessarily part of consciousness. So there may be an apple there, but that's trivial. What is important phenomenologically is what that apple means to you, and what that apple means to me. That may well be different.
Yeah.
That's what a phenomena is. A thing is just the natural existence of it. The phenomena is its significance.
So, what I think I was trying to get at is, we're not going for the thing in itself. We're not, you know, obviously. So Kant has kind of dismissed that, or said we can't, you know, we can't study that. So what we're left with, the thing itself is the noumena. Mm-hmm. So what we're left is the phenomena. When I think of phenomena, I always think of those cubist paintings in the early 20th century. So you have, like, you know, a guitar, but there's lots of guitars.
Because
we're seeing the guitar from many different ways. And that is, like, you know, the phenomena coming off of the guitar. yeah, coming off the Numina.
Yeah.
So, yeah, please correct me if I'm wrong here. Mm. So, what I think I understand this is a kind of science of the phenomena.
Mm.
Yeah, phenomenology.
Mm.
And what Husserl is trying to get at is okay, we're leaving behind the noumena, but we still have something in common. Everybody has something in common with the apple or the guitar. So we're studying that. We're trying to get at the essence in a different way.
Yes, yes. I think that's true. When he's talking about the... there are two ways in which phenomenology is kind of used by people like Husserl. So, you know, on the one hand, it's almost an existential thing. So it's mm. almost, how do you and I engage with our worlds? So, you know, I don't know, there could be a bottle of water, and we can reduce that bottle of water to its natural descriptions. And the natural kind of description of it, it's ontology, if you like, its existence, mm. according to Husserl, is kind of trivial. You can say it's H2O, it's made of these molecules, yada, yada, yada. That's fine. And kind of you and I can kind of agree on that. But it's not meaningful. It's not actually part of the conscious world. It mm. becomes a part of my conscious world when I start to attribute significance to it. So it might well be. So if I was talking to you... at a long distance, and you were sat in a desert, and I was sat in Great Britain in the pouring rain, as we kind of are today, then that water would have a different significance for you than it would for me. And so the phenomena of that water, the part of that, the phenomena of the water for you, would be part of your world, would be part of your phenomenal world. But it may not be the same for me. Now, what happens is Husserl talks about he talks about a kind of reductionism, and not reductionism in a kind of trivializing stuff. He says phenomenology, if you're studying the actual event, if you're studying what happens, because that's the other side of it. You've got the existential aspect of it, which is just what happens to you and me when we look at a bottle of water, or we look at an apple, or we look at or we experience love, or all of those things. Whatever happens to us, and however this is incorporated into our worlds, that's our consciousness. That's the intention of our consciousness, creating that world out of that phenomena. But phenomenology is also a discipline. And that's what you were getting at, I think. It's a way of studying. And this is when Husserl starts talking about reduction. And he says, what the phenomenologist is trying to do, and I have difficulties with this, actually.
Yeah.
He says, what phenomenology is trying to do is it's trying to reduce the experience to a kind of its essence. Mm. So it's kind of, okay, you know, if that particular phenomena has this impact on me and is part of my world for this reason and means this for this reason, what exactly is it doing to me to do that? Mm-hmm. And he has this kind of idea where he says, okay, what we're going to do here is we're going to reduce it. We're going to strip away external elements. So we're going to say, okay, if we're looking at, I don't know, the experience of love, and we can say, okay, we've had that experience. Okay, then you say, okay, well, how does that work for me? You say, okay, well, what does love, you know, what does love include? And what can we do away with? You know, is love, does love have to make you feel good? Well, you can say, well, not necessarily. Okay, well, that's not an essential part of what love is. Does love have to involve two people? Or can it be two things? Or can it be a person and a thing? Or
very Cartesian.
Yeah. So you start. Yeah, it is. It is. It's kind of that kind of almost that system. So you're stripping away all the things which, you know. It's that kind of, you know. It's almost that kind of Sherlock Holmes thing that, you know, once you've dismissed once you've dismissed
all the possible things,
and you know whatever's all left. Basically, you dismiss all the things you got. Whatever's left has to be the kind of the thing.
I can think of just. Sorry to interrupt. I just thought of two examples that I think might help me.
Mm.
So two examples of things. So the first thing is something I read before. So you have two billiard balls, and we're both looking at each of them, A and B. I'm looking at A, looking at B, and they're both white. And we're both having the same experience. We're having different experiences of them, but obviously there is a similarity between those experiences, and we can kind of reduce that to the whiteness of the billiard ball.
Mm-hmm.
That's example one. Example two is a bit more fun. Little plastic toys.
Oh man, yeah.
The little plastic toys, you know, you get in, I don't know, McDonald's or something like that.
Is that a minion? That's a minion you've got there.
It's a minion, yeah.
And
our adult experience of them, it can be quite fun. They look, funny, and I wonder who designed it. It's quite good. But to a child, if you can cast your mind back to this little crappy thing you might have got with a child, but what it meant to you. Experience of that. It's sometimes a little bit difficult to cast your mind back.
Yes.
But I remember I had this like little James Bond watch.
Oh.
I got like digital thing, and that was so precious to me.
Yeah.
And I remember like touching the plastic of it and feeling like this is so important.
Mm.
And so there's a kind of depth.
Yes.
Depth to that experience.
Yes, but you could reduce it. You could reduce that down, either to its natural description, which is just it's a bunch of plastic, and it's probably kind of not worth particularly much, and yada yada yada. But phenomenologically, it was a significant part of your conscious world.
Yes,
was it not?
So yes. I think what I'm trying to say is I think that for Searle it's more. It's not kind of, and that's where it goes on from being kind of analytic. It's like at first glance, first on the face of it, it seems like like a science. And when you think of science, you just think of these kind of analytical things. But it's more than that. It's like it's bigger, isn't it? I think that's where you get that this divergence.
Yes,
you get the analytical, and you get the British philosophers, and I think what Wittgenstein might make of this.
Who?
So he would, I think would. Husserl seems to like create a whole language.
Mm. Yes,
and he's got all these different words for stuff, and you can imagine Wittgenstein just like kind of rolling his eyes. You're wasting your time.
Yeah,
You're creating new puzzles, but. Mm.
Well, this has more. Husserl has more similarities with the latter Wittgenstein in some ways, because the latter Wittgenstein's language games, in some ways, has some passing similarity to the variety of phenomenological worlds that Husserl is talking about. It's interesting. I like the example you're using there, because we see this in Heidegger, who develops Husserl in a particular way. I mean, Heidegger is particularly interested in ontology, but time. So he's in his famous work Being in Time. He's actually talking about how the phenomena that we encounter vary with time. How the phenomena we encounter and how our consciousness engages with the world is determined by a world that was already there beforehand, and to some extent a world that we're anxious about in the future. So it's not just a kind of a single snapshot that this is the world that we live in. This is the phenomenological kind of consciousness. This is my world. It's constantly in flux. So Heidegger talks about situatedness. He says we are in a particular place, in a particular time and place, and that determines, if you like, our horizons. And in many ways, our horizons help us to kind of categorize the phenomena in the world. And we can only really interpret the world from where we stand. So it's kind of the idea, you know, you're not looking through the microscope in a kind of God's eye transcendental view, which the Enlightenment may have wanted to suggest to us and how religions construed God. We are not kind of, you know, we're contingent beings. We are dependent beings. So we're on the slide.
Mm.
We're not looking through the microscope. We're actually on the slide. And we can only see as far around that slide. You know, we're in the pizza, if you like. And we may not even see the edges of the pizza. So we might think to ourselves, well, you know, we're looking around us and you know, the world is pepperoni. And that's, you know, that's it. That's our perspective. I suddenly started to feel hungry. it's interesting when you it's quite interesting, and you probably know this yourself. It's quite interesting when you discover philosophers discovering things for the first time themselves, and you realise that all of this stuff isn't just like parachute. These people are not born with these great thoughts. They have to work at it. It's an exploration, and it's, you know, Husserl is very keen on this idea of exploration. We're trying to explore the phenomena of the world, how they mean things to us, through the smallest possible things. And there's a story that Sartre's Jean-Paul Sartre's partner recounts, Simone de Beauvoir, and she wrote an autobiography, and it's difficult to know how anecdotal and how apocryphal this is, but the way she recounts it, they were having, Jean-Paul, who was a bit moody at the time, Jean-Paul was meeting up with de Beauvoir and a guy called Raymond Aron, who was another kind of philosopher, sociologist, who'd come back from Germany full of the new phenomenology. He'd kind of, you know, been reading Heidegger, and he'd been reading Husserl, and he'd been meeting with Heidegger, was a mate of Heidegger's, and he'd come back. And they were sat there, as you and I would do, with their drink of choice. This guy, Raymond Aron, said, you know, for a phenomenologist, this glass with my drink in it, would give us endless philosophical discussion. Philosophy, you could take that glass and you could make meaningful philosophy out of it. And I think that is just wonderful. The fact that, you know, that philosophy, as we've often said, is to do with an experienced world. And it's not necessarily to do with some sort of big abstract set of ideas which you have to grapple with first before you can. And I know it's disingenuous to say this, given how difficult these people are to understand, people like this and so on. But putting that to one side for a moment, the fact that you can think, well, no, I don't have to understand, the big philosophical questions, have that kind of toolkit. I can just look at this cup, look at this drink, and say, you know, what does this mean to me? You know, why have I got this? I mean, this has got this cup. It's got like a Star Trek kind of, you know, motif on it. And this takes me back to my youth when I first started watching Star Trek. And I like the ideas in that. And I can think about the person who gave it to me. And I can think about what it does because I like tea. And all of these things. I've got a broken version of the same cup, which has a plant in it somewhere. And it has a different kind of, you know, phenomenological impact. Somebody will come to my house and drink tea out of this mug. And it'd be completely oblivious to.
And what's the difference between a mug and a cup?
So I like the fact that, you know, in a sense, Husserl is trying to give philosophy or philosophizing back to ordinary people, to people who are just encountering their world, and just saying, what makes this your world? You know, what you're conscious of this, you know, you feel you're in love, you feel you're hungry, you feel you're thirsty, you're seeing this object which you like, you're seeing this object that you don't like. This is philosophy. What, and then you ask the question is, why are you having that reaction to these things?